Thanks so much for being with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and our next guest has written a fascinating new book that looks at how all of our senses go into affecting the taste of our food and how scientists and chefs alike are using this information to help craft a more perfect dining experience. Our guest is Charles Spence, on the phone with us from Colombia. He is the head of the Crossmodal Research Laboratory at the University of Oxford, and his new book, again, called Gastrophysics, The New Science of Eating. What kinds of things go into making your meal more enjoyable? I hope you'll join in our conversation. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Charles, thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure.
Well, I tell you what, I really enjoyed your book, and it's a fascinating read. And, you know, the title, Gastrophysics, The New Science of Eating, maybe we should just start out by having you talk about how you define gastrophysics.
So it is a bit of an intimidating term.
Yeah.
But it's there to kind of capture two things. On the one hand, gastronomy. So we're interested in studying real people's experience of real foods, things that they enjoy eating, talking about, sharing, and coming back for more. And on the other hand, the physics comes from psychophysics, which is kind of a branch of psychology. And it's really the systematic study of what makes food taste the way it does to us. Not so much from a recipe perspective about ingredients, but more the everything else that goes into our dining and drinking experiences, from cutlery to plateware to lighting to music to company to our memories, our moods and our emotions. All of it, I think, plays a role. And this kind of new science of gastrophysics is there to try and help understand what really matters and to take the key insights and kind of translate them into a way, maybe starting at that high end with some of the top chefs, but saying ultimately there are insights that we can all adopt no matter what we're cooking, no matter for whom.
Absolutely.
For a better experience.
And essentially, taste isn't maybe all it's cracked up to be.
That's right. I think of all the senses, ironically, what goes on the tongue is probably the least important to our experience of flavor. If you look at the numbers that you'll find in the textbooks and in the science papers, people will say that something like 75 to 95% of what we think we're tasting when we're enjoying a food is really coming from what our nose gives us, not from what our tongue gives us. And sort of we all know that, I guess, if we've had a very bad head cold and our nose is blocked, we might all say food has lost its taste. Well, really, your tongue's working just fine. You still can taste sweet and sour, salty, bitter, umami. That's what your tongue gives you. But everything else that makes food pleasurable, the fruity, the meaty, the creamy, the citrus, the floral, the herbal, the burnt, all those notes in taste really come from our nose instead. And that's why that's, I think, much more important, as is probably the sight of food, because we never put anything in our mouths before looking at it first, trying to figure out what it is. Do I like it? And those visual expectations, again, are part of our experience of pleasure when it comes to food and drink.
I was fascinated by the whole color business that you talk about in the book. And by the way, Charles has good research to back up all of his comments here and everything you read in the book. But just the color, was it blue, wasn't it? That,
yes.
Talk about that for just a minute as an example, and then we'll take a call.
So blue is kind of an interesting color for food and drink. It's something that we've been told for decades would never succeed in the marketplace, that blue was kind of unnatural, and there were no blue foods, and hence nobody could sell us a blue drink or a blue food and get away with it. And yet it's kind of changed its role in recent years as a number of drinks companies have realized that to stand out on the shelf in the supermarket or store, if they go for an unusual color, like a bright blue drink, then it will capture our attention and maybe make us more likely to purchase that thing. So now we have, blue sort of fruit drinks, blue raspberries, kind of popular from a couple of Gatorade and Slush Puppy. And increasingly in the spirits and wine category, companies are now coming out with a blue white wine from Spain last year. And just last month, an Italian company came out with a blue Prosecco, a blue sparkling wine, all with the idea of capturing your attention. Maybe it makes you think, that seems a bit unnatural. I don't. But in fact, in most of these cases, they're using pea flour or something else to naturally give that blue hue. And all the way through to, I think, supermarkets now, especially in the UK, are getting very excited by delivering unusually coloured fruits and vegetables from, like, blue potatoes and, you know, your purple carrots and beyond. And so I think blue is being brought back into the marketplace and is more successful than maybe some of us might have thought.
And I was thinking about the mouth. There was a mouthwash manufacturer that you helped. They had orange-colored mouthwash, and it didn't taste as astringent as the blue or something, even though they were
same. Yep, and this is kind of quite often when companies approach us, it'll be because of problems like this. They've tried to stand out in the marketplace, and they've come out with a range of colors for their product, or they've given their kind of classic product a new color to capture attention, and then consumers say, well, it doesn't taste the same. What have you done? Put it back the way it was before. Stop messing with our brands. And it turns out they haven't changed the formulation in most of the cases. All they've done is change the color of the product. And yet, as soon as you see that color, your mind sets an expectation. And when I see a blue mouthwash, I maybe expect something that's going to be a bit harsher in my mouth, whereas an orange color, maybe I'm thinking of orange juice or something sweet instead. And it's those expectations set by eye that anchor and then ultimately do change what we actually taste, and hence can explain why people will write in and complain and say, you know, you've changed the taste when really all you've done is changed the color.
Well, let's go to Nate in Green Bay with a question. Nate, hello. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. Thanks, guys, for taking my phone call. It was more of a comment. I really love the gastronomy portion of the title of the book, and that I'm crazy about science and cooking, and I think if we go out of our way a little bit more with what we know, we can certainly make things a lot more tasty. For example, I always make sure I'm roasting for color and texture if I'm ever making a dish. I made some Korean short ribs over the weekend, and a lot of my guests were surprised how long it took for all the little extra details I went to make the dish even better. And partly, I roasted some beef marrow bones and used some of the marrow to make the marinade a little bit richer in it. And so just that's one of the tricks that I use.
That you use, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Nate, what about it? I'm sorry, Charles, what about it?
Yeah, I think those things that we do in order to enhance the eye appeal. And think about one of the things that comes up in the book is how so much of, I think, of the sort of ready meals, processed foods, microwave dinners, these kind of foods, while they're kind of convenient, one of the things that they miss out on is all of those kind of smells of preparation. You just stick it in the microwave, 5 minutes later, it's done.
Yeah.
And you're missing out on all of the smells of cooking and all the kind of anticipation that will get our salivation going and build up the anticipation too.
Absolutely. Nate, thank you for calling. Charles, could you go through the book and sort of how you have it set up? It's really fascinating.
So the book is sort of set up to look first at each of our senses. How important is what we see to what we taste, then about the role of smell, both the smell when we kind of smell the food cooking, but also the smells that get pulsed out of the back of our nose every time we swallow. A chapter on taste, what does our tongue really tell us, and how we live in different taste worlds, one person from the next. A chapter on sound, which is probably my favorite. So I think of sound as the forgotten flavor sense that, you know, makes crunchy, crispy, crackly, creamy and carbonated foods quite what they are. And a bit about touch, both the texture of foods, but also, you know, the feel of cutlery in the hand, the question of whether we shouldn't be eating more food directly with our hands rather than using this kind of peculiar thing, this cold, smooth steel of the knife and fork and spoon. And thereafter, I kind of go out into the world and take some examples from real situations like aeroplanes, kind of a particularly hostile environment in which to make food taste good, and say, what does knowing about the brain, what does gastrophysics bring to help us understand what's going on, and to help some of the airlines and their food providers deliver something that's a bit more tasty in the future without necessarily having to ramp up the unhealthy ingredients. I look at sort of theatrical dining, how many chefs now and food providers are starting to bring entertainment into the meal, how technology is coming to the table, how more of us might be eating from our tablet computer screens rather than plates in the years ahead, how we might be seasoning our food with our mobile phones through sonic seasoning, and how some of the other future trends like 3D food printing, that's something I'm not sure is going to affect many of us. But the robot chef is something that many people I work with are very worried about. Will our jobs be taken away when the robot line chef can cook the meals in the restaurant, mix the cocktails on the cruise ship? Does that mean the chef and the barista are out of the job? I think not, but it's interesting to see how technology is increasingly coming to our table and how it can be used ultimately to hopefully both entertain and make food more enjoyable, but ultimately to help many of us at home maybe keep the same sort of taste experiences but deliver something that's a little bit less unhealthy through almost tricking the mind into tasting things differently.
And the tablet idea was interesting to me. You know, I can imagine a tablet that's showing water or waves and you serving shrimp, I think is one, an example you used in your book.
That's right. And there are other sort of Spanish chefs, Elena Arzac in her Michelin starred restaurant over in Spain. She is serving some of her grilled seafood off a tablet that shows kind of like a hot coals of the fire. There are others who are thinking about, you know, playing the sort of sounds of the sea and the waves to enhance seafood. We've even had a few events recently thinking about what would be the perfect image or thing to sort of serve meat to. Is it a herd of mooing cows? Does that make your steak taste better? Or does that just bring you a little bit too close to the source of your food?
We have lots to talk about with our guest today, Charles Spence, author of Gastrophysics, The New Science of Eating. And we'll continue our talk with him right after we take a look at the news. You stay with us. Well, from the color of the plate to the soundtrack in your restaurant, there are a lot of surprising factors other than taste that go into your enjoyment of a meal. And I think more chefs and restaurants and food companies are catching on to that and thinking a lot more about it. Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network with my guest, Charles Spence. Charles is the author of Gastrophysics, The New Science of Eating. He's talking about the secrets behind why we experience food the way we do and how you can use this information in your own kitchen. Also, of course, taking your questions, so I hope you'll join in right now. If an open line's get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. And Charles, you write about sound, and of course I'm a radio guy, and so sound is something important to me, obviously. What I hear affects, obviously, how I think about things, and certainly that is the case in restaurants and elsewhere when it comes to food.
That's right. The kind of two examples I look at in the book are restaurants where, as fashions change and all that soft furnishing gets removed, all the cushions and the curtains and the tablecloths and the carpets, all the stuff that used to absorb the sound is being kind of stripped away to reveal more hard surfaces that reflect noise. Well, that's kind of combined with a penchant for some of those New York chefs to play the same kind of loud pumping music in the front of house, in the restaurant, as they have been playing all day to kind of motivate their staff while preparing the foods. That's kind of led to this cacophony of noise in many restaurants. And it's getting so bad in many places that the critics now are starting to not only rate the quality of the food that's served in some of these establishments, but also to give a noise rating to say, you know, between 1 and 5, where 1 and you can have a conversation, enjoy your food, and 5 is just so loud you cannot hear what the waiter's telling you about the specials, you can't communicate with your dining companions, and the experience is kind of suppressed, almost ruined as a result. So that's one real big problem. And the other one is in aeroplanes, funnily enough, where the loud sound of the engines coming in at about 80 to 85 decibels of noise when you're in flight, that has been shown to suppress our ability to taste sweetness in a food, to taste saltiness in a food, but actually enhances our ability to taste umami, that mysterious fifth taste that you find in tomatoes and Parmesan cheese, anchovies and so on. And that actually, I think, explains one of the great mysteries of air travel, which is why there are a quarter of the population who fly who will only ever order a tomato juice in the air or a Bloody Mary and never think of doing so down on the ground. And I think now, through gastrophysics, we understand what's going on, because the tomato juice and the Worcester sauce and the Bloody Mary, these both contain umami, the one taste that really does taste better when you're surrounded by a lot of engine noise. And hence people are almost kind of self-medicating in the air by the drinks that they choose. And that now the airlines are realizing what's going on and starting to put a lot more umami-forward menus into their cabins in terms of the food that they serve as well.
And you even talk about wine at some point, and the kind of wine that usually works best when you're flying.
That's right, and it's probably not for those who have the opportunity, the grand vintages of Bordeaux and elsewhere. The wines tend to be a little more tannic, because that doesn't taste so good up in the air. But instead, it's kind of a nice hypothesis floating around, as it were, at the moment, which is that certain of the New World wines seem to perform particularly well in the air and on the ground. And what might be going on there is that some of these wines, say the Chilean wines, maybe the grapes are grown and the wines are blended at something like 6,000 feet. Say the Catana Zapata vineyard is one example. It's around that altitude, and that's kind of exactly the same altitude that the cabin air pressure is set at, around 8,000 feet above sea level. So could that be why, if something tastes great at that altitude on the ground, surely then it'll also taste as good up in the air, and that might explain why it's the New World wines that do a better job than some of the old ones.
The fruitier kinds of wines.
As well, that's certainly something that and we're seeing now, not only kind of more thought to the best wines drink at altitude, but also people sort of starting to question why is the tea that we're given in the air the same kind of blends as on ground? Surely we might want to do things differently for that different kind of harsher atmosphere, where the cabin air pressure is lower, where the air is very dry, and with all this background noise. And beer, too. Almost anything you might think of drinking or eating could be designed differently, knowing about the mind and some of these other factors that influence taste. Through to that very simple thing that gets me is that when you're on an airplane and they say you want chicken or fish, and that's it. Well, everything you see from the ground, from studies in restaurants and in psychology departments and public health institutions, says the more descriptive the name you give to a dish, the more positive comments you'll get back from diners, from customers. And so just giving that simple chicken or fish is kind of the worst name you could possibly give.
Yeah.
Simply by adding a little bit of detail and description to make the passengers salivate, we'd probably end up with a better offering for us all.
Well, when you think of the names, too, Chilean, I think Chilean sea bass?
That's right.
The other word, the name for it?
So this used to be on menus for years and years in North America, in the UK and Australia, a sort of Patagonian toothfish. Something that you can almost imagine yourself reading a restaurant menu thinking, do I fancy that? Patagonian toothfish? Maybe not. Maybe I'll have the burger or the steak or something else. But simply when somebody decided to change the name to Chilean sea bass, suddenly sales in those three markets and beyond in North America, UK and Australia jumped by over 1,200%. Simply, suddenly it sounds like a much more desirable dish, this sustainable, healthy monster of the deep. And while I think most of the time, you know, if you're cooking for your friends at home or for the family, simply by changing how you describe what you're cooking, probably won't get you a 1,200% increase in how tasty your family say your food is. Still, there's a lot of room to play with there between the current names or the lack of names that very often we give to foods and what you can do to enhance the experience and kind of nudge people's behaviors towards healthier seafood in that case, through to the great study that just came out from the Yale Public Health last week, I think, saying if you're trying to get people to eat more vegetables, then calling it, you know, sort of sizzling zucchini and, you know, ultra crunchy, this, that and the other, giving more descriptive labels, and people will suddenly start going for those vegetable-rich dishes.
Mm. So that's something to think about. Let's Let's turn to Nettie next in Delafield. Hi, Nettie. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I find this absolutely fascinating, and I just wanted to share that when I was younger, which was in the 50s, I have a brother who's 3 years older. My mother did not cook on Saturday afternoon, so we were left to our own devices to make our own lunch. And my brother, even to this day, loves to cook, but he would always make vanilla pudding. And my first experience with blue food was he would put blue food coloring in the pudding, and it would turn a navy blue greenish kind of tinge, so no one else would eat it. And then he'd have it all for himself.
Oh, that's a great story, Nettie. Comment, Charles Spence?
Yes, yeah, I've heard from back at the end of the Second World War, that British school children, to sort of celebrate the end of the war, were also sort of served blue, red, and white potatoes, the British flag colours, and that Fanny Craddock, one of the very first of the TV chefs in the UK back in the sort of 50s and 60s, she too was well known for unusually colouring her foods. It would kind of discombobulate those who were being served. So it is maybe a good dieting tip. You're blue and you probably eat a little bit less than you otherwise might. Or certainly if you're trying to put somebody else off eating what you want to eat yourself, then that's maybe the best one.
Thank you, Nettie. And now that we're on blue, I'm reminded of the color of plates. There was some research on blue plates that would relating to saltiness. Talk about that for a minute.
Yep, so sort of blue plateware, as well as blue foods, is kind of interesting, and it's got a bit of a history in that if you go back to the sort of the Depression era in North America, then so the anecdote goes, those who were serving all-you-could-eat meals figured out that people would eat less if you gave them a blue tray to eat off, and hence this kind of notion of the blue tray meal deal, serve it on blue and people eat less. That's always been traditionally the view. But today we're seeing actually a kind of, especially for those who are older, who may be in care, who may be suffering from dementia, who are struggling to see the food that they're served against the white plate. Think of, mashed potatoes and creamy sauce against a white plate. That can be really hard to see what's food and what's the plate. Put that kind of food for that age group on a bright blue plate, and suddenly you see that consumption will go way up. And this can be especially important, and there have been studies done in UK hospitals showing that the patients in the hospital will eat a third more and hence recover faster when the food is served from a blue plate to enhance the contrast than off a traditional white plate instead.
And doesn't food taste a bit saltier on a blue plate?
I'm trying to remember. Yeah, so if you change the color of the food, then that will change the taste, and making something pinkish-red will probably make it taste sweeter to you. Making something kind of greeny-yellow will make it taste sourer. Browny-black, probably you're going to think bitter. And for salt, the two colors that come to most people's minds are kind of white and blue. Maybe from the blue of the ocean or the white of salt, who knows. But then giving that sort of blue plate work and then prime those kind of notions, a blue plate will be more associated with saltiness than with any other taste, and hence can be used to add a little bit of seasoning to a food. If you want to make your food spicier, then try serving off a very red plate. New research just out from Taiwan shows that spicy food is spicier on the red plate, and some other research just from the UK saying even the color of the napkins that you use can again prime certain tastes, and the pinkish red napkins will make your food taste just a little bit sweeter.
Yeah, really interesting. And coffee, I think you say somewhere in there, coffee tastes nearly twice as intense. Only two-thirds as sweet when it's drunk from a white mug rather than a clear glass one.
That's right. And this comes from, a lot of our research is, I'm not a chef myself. I do cook now and again, but we kind of work with the chefs and the bartenders and the baristas in the coffee shops. And this really came out of just conversations with an Australian barista who said, it's strange, it's bizarre. I sort of think I'm serving the same coffee every day to the customers in my coffee shop. And yet when I serve it from a clear glass cup or mug, people say different things about it than when I serve it from a white or a blue mug instead. Am I being daft here? It doesn't make any sense. How can it be that changing the color and the material of the cup changes the taste? And it sort of made perfect sense to us. So we went away and gave lots of people standard cafe lattes from white mugs, from blue mugs, and from clear mugs, and did indeed find a sort of change in the rate and intensity of the drink as a function of the cup colour. Maybe that's to do with contrast, because I guess when you look at a cup of coffee, you don't just see the colour of the coffee itself, you always see the colour kind of against the background of the cup. And that colour contrast can make things look stronger, more intense, fresher, and hence that can change your experience. Or maybe it's something about all the history of foods you've ever eaten in your life. Somewhere in your brain you keep track of, you know, ice creams normally coming in whiter bowls, cheese being served off black slates, and hence when you serve something or show something like a black, an angular plate where later in life people naturally think what's going to be on that plateware will be less sweet than they might otherwise do.
Yeah, interesting. Charles Spence, our guest, author of Gastrophysics, The New Science of Eating. Fascinating book, and I'm glad to have him with us today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Love to hear from you. This whole, you know, when you're, you know, for the person who's entertaining, I thought you had some really good thoughts about how you can use sound, how you can use even the tablecloths to make the experience a better experience for the people that you're serving.
Mm-hmm. I guess when we're cooking ourselves at home for our friends or family, then maybe we have sometimes different things in mind. Sometimes we're trying to have people walk away full but without serving so much food to help in weight management. Other times we're trying to create, you know, that most memorable of dinner parties, so people will be talking about it, the food you serve for days, weeks, months later. And in that kind of memorable meal category, then I think there are sort of simple things that any one of us can do that you can take direct from some of the top restaurateurs and chefs out there. So things that kind of stick in people's memory are delivering more sort of smaller courses. So I think our brain, when we see a dish, we'll take a mouthful, check whether that it's what we expect it to be, and then our brain kind of switches off as we pay more attention to our people at the dinner table and the conversations or the TV going in the corner. But by serving lots of small dishes, each new dish provides a potential hook for memory, something that's sticky, that people will remember for a long time afterwards. And another trick that many of the top restaurants will use is to provide an amuse-bouche or an amuse-grille, kind of a surprise course, a little mouthful of something that you weren't expecting. And that kind of surprise, gift, or present, again, is very sticky in memory. And these are the things that will stay with us for a long time. Through to, if you're serving some sort of ethnic cuisine, then why not try and match the music to the country? So if it's a bit of lasagna you're serving, maybe a bit of Dean Martin might make it taste a little bit more authentic. If you're serving Indian food, then a bit of sitar music can enhance the perceived authenticity of what you serve. Of course, think about the names you give a dish. Don't just plonk it down in front of people and say, there it is, dinner, but try and give a little descriptive label to get the taste buds going. And if you can, don't just do all the work yourself in the kitchen, but the more you can get other people involved in the act of cooking, the more invested they are in the process, and that too turns out to make food taste better. So even if it's just adding a few herbs in the kitchen or giving the pot a stir every now and again, that will actually help your guests to enjoy your food that little bit more.
Oh, interesting. Marty in Douglas County, we'll go to you now. Thank you for calling.
Okay, thank you. Say my husband is dealing with the after effects of radiation therapy that he had on his tonsil. He's got about 30% of his taste back. So your discussion about how coffee can taste stronger in a certain color cup, any other color enhancers of flavor that you would suggest? And just as an aside, I also find it interesting because I'm a potter.
Okay, there you go. Charles?
So, yes, I think sometimes those recovering from radiation therapy will also suffer from kind of metallic taste, both a loss of the basic taste of sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and then this emergence of this unpleasant metallic taste. But in our work with hospitals, we're working currently with a anti-cancer children's hospital in Barcelona in Spain, and they're looking at ways of engaging the other senses. So whether it's you losing your taste buds because of radiation treatment or because of old age, then why not use the other senses and think more about texture and crunch and crispy and crackly, add more auditory interest to a dish. If you think that, you know, 70 to 90% of the taste of the food really comes from the nose, then anything you can do to enhance the aroma, both when the food is sitting there in front of you, just a sniff, the contents will add to the flavor experience, and be more playful visually as well by making food look beautiful on the plate, playing with color contrast. We, you know, in our hands with the chefs we work with in Oxford, we turn salads into Kandinsky paintings. Don't just serve it as a tossed salad, but, you know, make it look beautiful on the plate. That can be fun. And pretty much whatever you serve can enhance people's experience, even if they have somewhat suppressed taste buds.
All good tips. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have, you mentioned sound, I think, was great. I love the idea of Italian music. If you're serving lasagna or something like that, you also, I think, said if you've got a checkerboard draping that you can put over a tablecloth, that kind of adds to that sort of scene as well. And so there are a lot of ways that you can enhance the experience through all kinds of things other than just the taste of the food.
That's right. And there's something, you know, if you think you're in some on holiday in a foreign country and you're thinking, where should I go to eat tonight? And then maybe it's that red and white checkered tablecloth that is such an iconic feature of kind of Mediterranean cuisine, and just sort of capturing that in the home, thinking about the everything else can help. And from the book itself, people have done the systematic studies and they serve exactly the same food to people, either in just a regular canteen, or when they put the red and white tablecloth on, when they play the Italian music, when they give the food an Italian name, when they put a wine bottle in the middle of the table, an Italian flag on the wall, and suddenly ratings go way up of the perceived ethnicity and the enjoyment of the dishes that are being served. So it can be a sort of simple as that. And you think if you're going to spend time, if you care so much about the food that you serve, don't ignore the everything else. And what you see going on in restaurants, even those restaurants that are sort of, you know, wholesome, free-range, organic, locally sourced, seasonal cuisine, they're sort of doing some of the same things intuitively, I think, when they, you know, when you walk into the restaurant or pass the front window and they have baskets of fruit and vegetables there. That, again, is setting expectations through the ambience, through the atmosphere, that will carry over to affect your enjoyment of the food that you ultimately eat.
In our last minute, have you got one more nice tip for those who are cooking at home to make their food experience better?
The simplest one has to be eat with heavy cutlery. A heavy knife and fork will make food taste better than it otherwise would. We've shown this in the lab. We've shown this in hotel restaurants. Intuitively, if you go to a restaurant, sometimes the top quality restaurants do have heavy cutlery, and that's something you can easily incorporate into the home environment and will have a beneficial effect on whatever it is that you serve.
Well, I have to say that I've really enjoyed reading your book, and it's a fantastic read, Charles, and I thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. We didn't get to a tenth of what you have in it, but I really appreciate your time with us today. Thank you so much.
That's a pleasure. Thank you.
Charles Spence is the author of Gastrophysics, The New Science of Eating. I highly recommend this book to you. I really enjoyed talking with him, really enjoyed reading the book, and I'm pretty sure you will as well. Well, tomorrow at this time, our insect expert, P.J. Leash, from the Insect Diagnostic Lab at UW-Madison, will be along to answer all your questions about all those summer bugs that may be affecting you personally or affecting your garden. So I hope you can join us for that. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots more in store.
Thank you to all of our members. As a listener, you make our work worthwhile. As a member, you make it all possible. You ensure that there are 24 hours a day of engaging, thought-provoking programs on WPR. Programs that hundreds of thousands of people rely on every week. Thank you for your support.